Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And how are you today? Wow. Hey, you know what? It is the last Saturday in February. Does that mean that we're in a leap year, a 27th year? Okay, I don't know, but it's very interesting to consider. Wow. Okay, so this is an interesting week. We've had a lot of revelations. I posted an article I wrote. I think I wrote it about a week ago. Called Technology of Ancient Mesoamerican Science. And it's based on the Feather Serpent Temple in Mexico. It's part of the major complex that we just don't know about this complex, how it was built, who actually engineered the complex itself. But to Teotihuacan, which is the ancient city south of Mexico City. I have not been there yet. I'm planning on going, but I've studied most of the pyramids, and I've been particularly interested in the Feather Pyramid, the Feather Serpent Pyramid, which is in the far end, east of the main pyramid, the Pyramid of the Sun, which is next to the Pyramid of the Moon. But it's funny, because if you study the Aztecs called Teotihuacan birthplace of the gods. That's what Teotihuacan means, birthplace of the gods. And I believe that most of the archaeological evidence of mass ritualistic killing and things like that, or the bones, that was of a people, probably the Aztecs, who came thousands of years after the builders of this great place had left. But what's specifically of interest in this article is that the mechanics of the pyramid. Now, the more and more we study pyramids, the more we discover that a lot of them were engineered with a specific purpose of either generating energy, generating power, sound, all kinds of possible energetic fields were created. This specific field at this Feather Serpent Temple Pyramid in Mexico reveals some fantastic qualities. And the article I wrote discusses what they found when they were excavating one of the tunnels. Now, this has been going on now since 2013. And the article discusses these pyrite balls that they found, just literally thousands of these balls that were buried in the dirt. And what they also found was canals. Now, they used a number of robots to pass through to go to the center of the pyramid, to go into other sections of the pyramid. And they found over 14, or is it 15? 14 or 15 separate cut canals that travel and transverse this pyramid. And it appears that these balls were carried in water. And this is the other thing that is quite unique. In the photographs that we have been taken, there appears to have been water that was brought in, flowed underneath the pyramid and around these canals, carrying these pyrite balls and possibly some other chemicals that created a reaction. My guess is the reaction was carried out underneath the pyramid. No one has to date tested this pyramid to see if it's on top of a geomagnetic telluric field, which is a field that pulses up like a volcano in with the lava would be bubbling up. A telluric field bubbles up from the ground into the atmosphere. What we don't know is if there is a telluric field. My guess is there is. My guess is that this was some kind of energy generator. What makes it even more unique is that the pyramid sits on a artificially created mound outside in front of it, spanning about a 400-foot square, are these pods, these stone pods, and they're all connected via granite sidings. They're all in line. And if you look at this image of this master created pyramid with these pods from above, it looks like a grid. It looks like a what they call a PC board, where you have the chips and then you have the connecting chips that go around, and they're all fused together. And they're all linked together with a line of solder or something that carries the charge. And what I believe is, and that's what this article discusses, and by the way, the article is located on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page, Technology of Ancient Mesoamerican Science. And what I believe is pyramid complex was like a massive semiconductor board. Energy was generated up into this pyramid and then distributed to these pods, these platforms. And you can see it all here on the page here on Facebook. And the question is, what were on those pods? I would love to do a chemical analysis or have somebody do chemical analysis of these pods, because it's a good bet that something was generated up into those pods. And we just don't know. I mean, it's always been my theory, because of the way that Teotihuacan is laid out. It's laid out like an airport, and the Avenue of the Dead, which is the road, was probably a runway of some kind. So that's getting kind of out there, but you know, why generate power? Why have a pyramid generate energy and then distribute it to these pods and these platforms? If they're not going to be used in some manner. Now, maybe it's some kind of gigantic computer. I mean, it's monstrous if it's a computer, but I think that that whole area was used for some type of vehicle propulsion. And we'll have to discuss that at some other time. But anyhow, check out the article. It's on Facebook. Go to the groups. Go to Earth Ancients. And it's a short article. It's about 600 words, and it discusses this discovery, and also my belief in probably what the actual facility was used for. It talks a little bit about my friend John Burke too, so check that out. The other thing that is kind of interesting is there is an article I also posted on robots. And robots are spoken about in the Hindu Vedas, artificial machines, artificial intelligences. And what they describe in the verses are very, very sophisticated human-like machines. And what I posted is our current science's attempts to create an artificial being that's very, very close to being human. In fact, they kind of walk human-like. And you can see these guys moving around in this video that I posted on Earth Ancients Facebook. Very strange. The fluidity of their movements is getting scary. It's, especially when they're moving stuff around. They have them do some obstacles. They pick up boxes and they put them on shelves. One of the engineers actually pushes one of these robots down. It gets up on its own and walks away. So something to consider. It's kind of scary in a way because, you know, who knows what's coming up for us. So technology, yeah. I mean, maybe we're coming back to where we were technologically speaking. Maybe we were really, really sophisticated. So check that out, Earth Ancients Facebook. Oh, it's interesting. We are slowly turning into a network. I've just recently signed Hutton Pulitzer, who you know from the History Channel. He will be hosting his own show. We're hoping to launch him within the next couple of weeks. He is known as the History Heretic. And he will be doing a weekly show. I believe it's going to be Sunday, but I will announce it officially when he is ready to launch. I'm excited about Hutton. He's got some great material, and that will be under the Earth Ancients banner. I will announce it. I will also post it on the Facebook page and have it listed on the Blog Talk Radio Network page too. We're going to have a special website, a listing page of the other hosts. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised at some of the other people from the History Channel, from Ancient Aliens, from a number of TV shows that we are going to be producing. And this is going to be your one-stop place for not only ancient history, but a lot of other subjects that encompass interest. So check it out. All right. So today we have Michael Tellinger, and Michael is nice enough to take some time out of his day to sit with me. This is interesting. He has a new program right now. I've seen some episodes of it. It is called Hidden Origins. It is produced by the Gaia TV Network. And if you go to Facebook, you can see the link. And I believe the first two episodes are free of charge. They're not charging for those. And also, here's a little secret. If you go to Michael Tellinger's website, you can see the first four episodes. They're short. They're about 30 minutes, but he packs a lot of information in these programs. And I found they were pretty interesting. So I thought they were well done. Michael's always an interesting interview. I think you'll like this interview. And so here it is.
Go ahead, Fazit.
Hey, man. Hey. Good to talk to you. I'm glad you called
me.
Yeah,
you too.
I couldn't.
Can you hear me clearly enough?
I hear you good. You sound great. Hey, listen, thanks for joining me again. This is kind of a follow-up to our last talk, and so much has happened for you in your not only your great travels, but Gaia TV has launched this new program, Hidden Origins, and I wanted to talk a little bit about it because I've seen a couple of the programs, and they're outstanding. And I was just curious, they have basically given you an open forum to just go at it and go and just really unveil your material to probably a pretty broad audience. What was did they come to you, or was it something that somebody came up and said, "Hey, Michael, we love your stuff. Let's do it." Or what was the genesis of that?
Well, thanks. First of all, thanks very much, Cliff, for having viewed some of the shows, and thanks for your warm and generous positive feedback. I was a guest on Gaia TV a few times with several of their presenters, mostly my friend Regina Meredith, mm-hmm. Who's one of the top hosts on Gaia, and one of the female hosts that is really holding the feminine power and at the channel very firmly.
Okay.
And I've been a friend of Regina's for many years now, and it was great having her introduce me to the Gaia family, really. Mm-hmm. So I've got to say thanks to Regina for introducing me to the people there, and vice versa. And then I met Jay Widener during my visits there.
Oh.
And Jay and I really clicked, and you know, we Jay's like my long lost brother. And I really respect him, his work and his research. He's an incredible guy.
Okay.
And he's the in-house producer there at Gaia. So over the past few years, we just got talking, and every time I go back there and do another interview with you know, either Regina, or I did two interviews with George Noori as well. And then eventually George and Jirka, the CEO, called me in and said, "Look, would you like to do a show on your own? Because people seem to like your material. They really like you and how you talk and how you present your stuff. And we think that if you put all your stuff together and into a nicely woven storyline, it'll go down really well." So obviously I said, "Fantastic! It sounds great." And it seems to be working, so I'm very happy, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it started in January with your first opening, your introduction, and it's going, what, it's a 16-part series? Is that what it is?
Yeah, 16 half hours, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we continued. I went back to Boulder, Colorado, and we shot another 8 one-hour episodes of the Ubuntu Contributionism Philosophy. A workshop that will be released very soon as well. So, mm-hmm. And that really goes into the history of money, the origins of money, the banking families, the use of money as a control tool and so forth, and then into Ubuntu and contributionism as a solution for our economic woes and the problems. So it's a great platform to share that information as well.
That's fantastic. I want to talk about Ubuntu in a minute, but I want to kind of pick up where we left off. We were talking about the Anunnaki when we last spoke, and what you had discovered in South Africa as well as other places in the world. But the theme, Hidden Origins, kind of follows your feeling that we are a species with amnesia. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because you believe that a huge part of Earth's history has been either clouded or hidden or pushed away, simply because the victors, as you call them, the winners of wars and rebellion, have written or rewritten history. Can you talk a little bit about the amnesia of our species and why you feel this is so important for us to know?
Well, absolutely. It's very obvious that we're a species with amnesia, because just asking the simple question, who are we, where do we come from, and why are we here, we just simply have no answers. We have no idea. And it becomes a huge challenge for most of us to try and deal with those questions. And it generally leads to arguments and conflict, just those ideologies and those thoughts. It really leads to religious conflict. It leads to political and philosophical conflict. It leads to disagreements about ownership of land and who owns what and who's entitled to what, and it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And a complete exhibition of our ignorance about science and physics and the laws of nature and everything goes around us, and it just highlights the fact how disconnected we are from our environment, from our planet, and from everything around us. It's like we're this completely isolated organism on this planet that just has no part or no place in the makeup and the melting pot of what's going on around us.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it became clear that the fact that we don't know these things, and we should, if we knew who we are, where we came from, and why we're here, we would have the answers at the tip of our fingers and immediately be able to spew forth everything about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case.
Yeah, Graham Hancock talks about the same kind of thing in his new book, and he said actually Fingerprints of the Gods has a little bit of it, and the Magician of the Gods also picks up where he left off, where there's a tremendous amount of history that is either suppressed or just is not recognized as valid. And what upsets him and other people, Michael Cremo, and I pick up a lot of it too, especially when it comes to Central America, because my feeling is the story of the Maya is all screwed up and they got it wrong. And they have the dates wrong. But what is it specifically for you that you feel is the real? I mean, there's probably thousands of examples that you could give, but what are some of the main examples you could say? Well, look, this is what I discovered. This has been suppressed. And this is knowledge that really is a foundation for humanity.
Well, first of all, it's very obvious when you look at all the ancient sites around the world, and I'm talking about the well-known sites, the famous sites, not the hidden and obscure sites, because they shroud in even more mystery. But the obvious sites, like Stonehenge, for example, you know, the fact that Stonehenge was reconstructed in 1954,
mm-hmm.
With giant cranes and engineers, and they dug up the stones and reconstructed Stonehenge to look what it looks like today. Not many people are aware of that, and it came as a surprise to me when I discovered this. But with the surprise came an immediate realization that that wasn't by accident. That was not an attempt to try and reconstruct the site into what it was originally like. It was an attempt to reconstruct the site so that it looks more recent, so that it doesn't look as old and as dilapidated as it really was.
Hmm. Yeah.
And in there lies a hidden agenda. And archaeology and archaeological digs and expeditions are used by politicians and political leaders, and especially the banking elite, with a very specific agenda to prove a specific point that they then want to shove down the throats of the public, hmm. of the people. And it was used by the apartheid regime in South Africa. It was used by the Nazis. It was used by the British all over the world. Mm. And it continues to be used by the global elite today. And Stonehenge for me is a great example, because so what I normally explain to people is that the history of our planet is much older and much more weird and mysterious than most of us could possibly imagine.
Right.
And by that, I mean much, much more older and much more weird and unimaginable to us. Even in my wildest dreams can we probably not imagine what was going on here. It is so outside of our realm of trying to piece it together.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you start reading the works of people like Anton Parks, the French researcher that has written a tremendous amount on the Sumerian texts and the Anunnaki and the other beings, other hordes of many, many beings that have been present here on Earth,
mm-hmm.
in the recent and distant past. Let alone if you start looking at the stuff that was written by L. Ron Hubbard. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, everyone thought he was crazy. But the more you look at the stuff that he wrote then, he's probably closer to the truth than most people realize today.
Yeah.
And so it goes, you know, it's just spectacular. So Stonehenge, in a way, is a great example to use to show and indicate how old it is because of the geology of the rocks there.
Mm-hmm.
Stonehenge is made up of Sarsen stone mainly and some other stone, I think it's bluestone and whatever else is there. But Sarsen stone is very, very hard rock. And one of the main two very tall stones at Stonehenge is still standing up, and the other one has fallen over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that was dug out, and many of the other stones that are standing up are actually dug out and put upright and fixed with concrete. And it's just a farce.
Yeah, you actually talk about that in your introductory presentation on Gaia TV, Hidden Origins, and you describe one of the following stones in such a way that because of the weathering, you think it could be a million-year-old structure or older, which I found was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just look at the crack. You know, the one of the two tall stones fell down and broke.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if a stone, especially as hard as Sarsen stone, breaks and cracks, that the erosion on that break, if it is only a few thousand years old, 5 or 6 or 7 thousand years old, the erosion on that crack will be, you know, maybe half an inch or maybe an inch, mm-hmm. if that, probably less, much less. And yet we look at that break on that stone, and it's like 2 feet of erosion. You know, the edges are so rounded that they look like two separate stones. It doesn't even look like it used to be one stone.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's just no geologist has brought it up or picked it up. And I just, when I first went there, I couldn't believe my eyes. Have people not seen this? It's so obvious that we're dealing with something extremely old.
Yeah.
And it's just completely ignored. And that's how I like to look at things, looking at evidence and little pieces that are often missed by others. I guess it jumps out to me for reasons that I don't quite yet understand. But
yeah. So it's hard for you, and it's hard for me, and hard for a lot of other researchers to kind of fall or use the current paradigm of history, which is the Neolithic and then the Middle Ages and so on and so forth, a nice linear point of view, where if we study the ancient Hindu texts like the Yugas that go into hundreds of thousands and millions of years ago, that changes the whole perspective of our planet. And I tend to focus on that, because I believe, and you can see it in Michael Cremo's books and other people's books, of evidence of modern humans that have been discovered that are millions of years old and found all around the Earth. So I guess what's interesting about what you're saying in Hidden Origins is that we need to look at the new evidence and the evidence that's been out there that's been suppressed, and kind of get our heads around the possibilities of an extremely old, and as you call it, weird Earth, which is kind of interesting. So I guess, you know, Stonehenge is a great example of a megalith. And it seems like, and you talk a little bit about this, that the previous civilization was destroyed. We know now that the Younger Dryas event was the kind of the beginning of the floods, but is it your opinion that the previous generation were megalithic builders?
Absolutely, and the megalithic builders were building things for very different reasons to what we've also been misled to believe.
Mm-hmm.
What my conclusions are, and I showed in some of my presentations, that pretty much all of the ancient sites that I've looked at, whether it's the pyramids, whether it's the temples in Egypt, the stone circles in southern Africa, Borobudur, and so many, many more other ancient sites, are all energy-generating devices.
Yeah.
And it's just silicon-based technology on a giant scale. And that's the big surprise. And I was led to that conclusion because I realize that we're dealing with ancient technology, and the stone tools that I've been picking up in South Africa are a very, very clear indicator of advanced technology.
Mm-hmm.
And not just a guess that it's advanced technology. It's very, very obvious advanced technology. It's been measured, and we're dealing with SASER, mostly sound, as a tool of and a source for the energy. And that suddenly becomes the central theme in all these ancient sites, from the temples of Egypt to the pyramids to Stonehenge. It's all to do with sound, resonance, and frequency.
Yeah.
And this is why these sites were aligned with the movements of the sun and the equinoxes, because it actually used the sun and the sunrise on specific times of the year to act as an activator for that particular machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the sun rises and the first light beams go through a tunnel and end at the edge of at the end of the tunnel, and it hits upright standing stone, which is made of what? Which is made of rock, a stone. Most of it is very high content of silica, quartz, and you realize that we're dealing with quartz and silicon-based technology on a gigantic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sunlight, which is a specific frequency, activates that. That stone, that standing stone, like a giant crystal, and it makes the machine perform a specific task, a specific function. It switches it on, and then when the sun moves to the equinox or the solstice on the other side, it then performs a different function. It's like hitting enter on your computer, and the machines are controlled by the movement of the sun. They don't need human intervention.
That's interesting. Last couple of guests I've had have talked about the pyramids at Giza, and one gentleman specifically, William Vittman, describes the pyramid as a machine, and I'm curious about your thinking. It seems like the previous civilization had an understanding of naturally occurring geomagnetic fields under the ground, and was able to tap those either through man-made structures or on top of naturally emitting fields. Do you believe that the previous civilization had a technology behind that, or did they just kind of tap it? And I mean, it seems like there's a real case for lost science all over the place. I mean,
absolutely.
We just don't know. Like you mentioned certain types of energetic fields. I think piezoelectric energy using crystals were used. But is it your belief that there's more than one science that's been lost that was a power generation science?
Absolutely. And I can say that with absolute confidence because of my discovery, and I guess that's my contribution towards that field of history, archaeology, and specifically ancient science. Unraveling what you said, a lost science, by presenting the physical evidence of the stone circles of southern Africa. And there are millions of these stone circles, not just a few hundred or a few thousand. My calculations clearly show that there are probably more than 10 million of these ancient structures that have become known as the stone circles of southern Africa, all interconnected by these channels that are like two wires that connect all the stone circles together. Each one of the stone circles, we have to conclude that each one generates energy because every single one we've measured does that. And then there are specific of the ones of these circles that take on the shape of magnetrons, giant magnetrons, you know, 40 meters in diameter magnetron that made of silica, of quartz, that would generate insane amount of energy that we can't even imagine. And we have thousands of these giant magnetrons all plugged in to this network of stone circles, each one of them generating a huge amounts of energy, creating a giant a network of energy devices and like an energy grid that covers vast parts of southern Africa. And this clearly shows us that there was a civilization of beings here, whoever these beings were, that used the earth as the resonator, the frequencies, the subtle energies and vibrations and the sound frequencies coming out of the surface of planet Earth, and utilizing those energies and amplifying them into more powerful sound frequencies through the erecting the stone walls upon those cymatic patterns, because that's exactly what these stone circles are. Each stone circle represents the cymatic pattern and the shape of the sound as it as it emerges from the earth there.
Mm-hmm.
Like putting sand on a metal plate, putting a sound frequency from underneath it. Each frequency has a very specific and unique shape that makes that the sand takes on. So it's what one can refer to as the manifestation of physical form through sound. And you realize how this was used in these millions of stone circles. And this is just spectacular. And so this is why I said sound and resonance being the source of the generation of this energy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only source they used. I think they may have used light as well. And light has a frequency and a sound attached to that as well. Because every frequency of light has a sound attached to it as well. It's just we can't hear it. And so it goes. You know, the temples of Egypt are just spectacular examples of gigantic circuit boards. Those temples are just, you know, silicon-based technology and circuit boards on a gigantic scale that we just could not imagine today.
But there must be something missing when we talk about the Great Pyramid, because we had Chris Dunn on the show who analyzed the pyramid, and he's an engineer, of course. His big thing is to show that ancient Egyptians, not too ancient, would have been Ramses II, which is maybe 5,000 years ago, had a technology that allowed them to cut stone, granite, polish sculptures, and do stuff like that. So I guess the powering of that was done, he believes, from the pyramids that were in the area. But there must be something missing. I mean, it's just to have the pure granite and the energy passing through the granite, there must be some components that have either been destroyed or were taken away or something that is something that connects it all as some kind of a repository. For lack of a better word, it would be a battery, wouldn't you say?
Well, I don't think you need batteries. These people were far too advanced. They didn't need batteries. And people that go down that path are thinking in conventional Newtonian physics mm-hmm. kind of terms, you know. And unfortunately, I disagree with that completely. These people didn't need batteries. They tapped into the universal field of energy, sound and resonance, which is, that's it. It's everywhere. It's you know, and remember that the according to Nassim Haramein's formula and the scientific papers he wrote on this whole issue of sound and resonance and the vacuum, the density of the vacuum is infinite, and it is that it's based on that brilliant breakthrough understanding of, and when I talk about the vacuum, or when Nassim refers to the vacuum, he's not speaking about space. We're talking about the zero point where matter disappears and dematerializes into the morphogenetic field, into that ether out of which things materialize or dematerialize into. The density of that vacuum, as he calls it, is infinite. And that's how we can explain how sound and resonance travels infinitely fast and manifests anywhere, anytime, instantly. And it doesn't take any time at all, because remember, the denser the medium, the faster sound travels and resonance travels. So if you have an infinitely dense medium, that means the information in the form of sound and resonance travels infinitely fast. So that's an explanation that we can share with people when we say sound travels beyond the speed of light, and not just beyond the speed of light, it travels infinitely fast.
Okay, interesting.
And therefore your thoughts and your ideas and every word you speak and everything you say and do goes into the nucleus of every cell of your body. It goes into the nucleus of the atoms that make up those cells. And in the nucleus of those atoms, it disappears and goes into that vacuum, that morphogenetic field entrance, and instantly is accessible to everything in existence, anywhere and everywhere, that anyone and everyone can tap into and pick up on those things. And this is how we could communicate with each other across the universe and across other dimensions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that is a very simple lesson in that bit of science and I guess multidimensional physics, if one can call it that.
Yeah.
But what I don't know why I brought that up. I know I was going somewhere with it.
Yeah, I was talking about advanced science and how it was applied.
Yes, and the battery and the storage of batteries. And
yeah.
And what it comes down to is really the resonance, because remember that sound and resonance are the common denominators in virtually every ancient civilization, from the Bible to the Hindus to the Mayas to the African civilization to the Aboriginal people or the Aborigines of Australia, all the ancient stories of creation have an element of resonance, that God said, let there be light, or things materialized out of the thoughts of God, which were sound frequencies and resonance and so forth. So it's clear to us that, clear to me at least, that sound and resonance are the primordial source, is a primordial source, and is the great the source of all creation. And it is this energy field that the ancients were tapping into, sound and resonance.
Let's talk about these circles that you found in South Africa. What's the date, if you could give a date? Is this 400,000 years plus for these generators, or are we not sure simply because we can't date rock?
It's very difficult to date rock. You know, the very sort of broad indicator is what I refer to as the patina growth on these rocks, mm-hmm. on the tools and artifacts, because obviously the tools and artifacts were made by somebody at some stage.
Yeah.
So from a basic raw rock. So if you use the rock that I have in my museum, which is known as Hornfels, it's this black rock. It rings like a bell, and right. It's actually known as ringstone by the geologists. Mm-hmm. And if you sculpture or mold that rock into a shape, and I emphasize the word mold here, because most of the tools and artifacts I have look like they've been molded, not sculptured.
Huh.
And also that particular rock, the ringstone rock, has a tendency to break and flake if you try and chisel it or chip it. So it looks like all these tools and artifacts were molded. Mm-hmm. And once you've molded or created that tool artifact, it would have the color of the raw natural rock, which is black, charcoal black. And yet all these tools and artifacts are covered in patina, several millimeters thick in some cases. And that's impossible for it to be just a few thousand years old. That patina would have taken more than 100,000 years to grow to that thickness.
Okay.
So that's a very broad indicator that these structures are probably, you know, 300,000 years old, maybe older. And that brings us to the technology that you were talking about. You know, the fact that these ancients had some sort of technology with which they could cut or create or cut or prepare the stones for the pyramids and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think I present a very good argument for those tools, and I call them the cone-shaped tools, the cones.
Yeah.
And that's just spectacular, because the discovery that when I first started picking up these cone-shaped tools around the stone circles in South Africa, I was very confused why suddenly there was this plethora of these weird-looking ice cream cone-shaped tools, you know, of all shapes and sizes, some big, some small, some refined, some not so refined. And then I started realizing that these cone-shaped tools are present in all ancient cultures right across the planet, from Australia to the Mayas to the Incas to the ancient civilizations in Europe, in ancient mines, in Egypt. The Egyptians' hieroglyphs are just and imagery is full of cone-shaped tools being presented to the gods. The gods are holding cone-shaped tools. The funerary cones that you find in Egypt, where people were buried with these funerary cones by their side, inscribed with things like true of voice, referring to sound as in voice. The fact that cone-shaped tools are used in ancient cultures to inaugurate kings and on their heads. The fact that wizards and witches' hats are cone-shaped, and wands, wizards' wands are cone-shaped, and you start realizing, okay, hold on, there's a definite common denominator here, and it all fell in place for me when I heard a story about Edlid Skolnin, in
Coral Castle, yeah,
Edlid Skolnin that built Coral Castle in the 1920s, mm-hmm. single-handedly built Coral Castle out of giant granite blocks, coral blocks.
Right.
And the largest, I just recently found out that the largest stone in Coral Castle weighs 90 tons.
Hmm.
I mean, that's insane. You know, you don't do that. You don't do that on your own. You can't do that. It's impossible.
Yeah.
And anyone that claims, oh, he had this, or you use ropes and pulleys, is just, you know, either they're taking drugs or they've never actually worked with heavy rock, because it's just impossible. You know, anything more than 300, 400 kilograms, or even 200 kilograms, is already an almost impossible for one single person to work with.
Mm.
So Elie Scanlan did something that is truly remarkable with tools and artifacts that we have not yet figured out. And then he was spotted one day of levitating these giant coral stones, several tons, and he was described of doing it with ice cream cones in his hands.
Oh, my God, and really? Okay.
Yes, and to an uninformed mind, uninformed person, that just sounds ludicrous. Some kids saw him do it and they didn't understand what he was doing, so they just made up a funny story. But no, in there, for me, lay the clue that these cone-shaped tools are the key to levitation and so forth.
Hmm.
So I've done many presentations where I talk about this in a lot more detail. And then it gets even more interesting, because before I go to the levitation thing, you know, what happens is if you put sound and resonance through a cone that has got acoustic properties, like the Hornfell stones, or any kind of quartz structure that tapers like a cone, what happens is that it creates a vortex. The sound starts to speed up because it is pushed towards the apex of the cone,
mm-hmm.
and the sound spirals faster and faster and faster until it hits the tip of that cone, at which point it starts to move beyond the speed of light.
Hmm.
And in a tiny little vortex that distorts gravity around it. And this is where you get into the knowledge of, you know, vortex fields create gravity distortion around them.
Wow.
And now you've got a very clear understanding how these ancients used the ice cream cones or the cone-shaped tools by putting sound frequencies through them, somehow generating those. This is what we don't yet understand,
mm-hmm.
is how they got the sound and the resonance into the cones that then were shot out like phaser beams. And this is also a relatively new thing, phaser technology as opposed to laser technology. And suddenly we have a phaser beam that distorts gravity, and with it you can do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Not only levitate stones, if you know how to tune the frequency, and the emphasis there is on tuning, right? Everything has to work with harmonic resonance, tuning and understanding of these resonance frequencies and so forth. And then it means you can levitate things. You can distort the molecular structure of a stone so that it becomes soft, malleable.
Hmm.
You don't have to heat it up. You can just mold it like plasticine or, you know, play clay and mold it into a shape you want, and then you remove the frequency and the rock gets hard again instantly.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And this is how we start to understand, for example, the shaping of the weird shaping of the rocks at Sacsayhuaman. You know, we got those large walls that are referred to as defensive walls,
mm-hmm.
that run up to the hilltop at Sacsayhuaman in, was it Peru or Bolivia? I forget now.
Peru, yeah, Cusco.
Peru, yeah. And once again, you know, it's called, very ignorantly, our historians and archaeologists say that these are defensive walls. Well, it's absolute nonsense, because if you look at those giant walls at Sacsayhuaman, they run in a zigzag shape,
mm-hmm.
which means they create corners. And it's very easy to climb up a corner, you know, when you got a wall coming together, then it's going to be very easy to scale that wall. So they're certainly not defensive walls.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at them from the air, they create this weird zigzag shape that runs into what is on top of the hill, a very obvious giant ancient circuit board. Right. Just like the temples in Egypt.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's amazing.
And it seems to me that those three walls, which create two channels between them at Sacsayhuaman, were possibly the role that they played was to, as the wind channels through there, the weird zigzag shape creates a specific frequency or injects a frequency into the wind because of the way that the walls are built. And that frequency creates a resonance that then travels between the walls and activates the circuit board, which is on top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. This is what I've identified Sacsayhuaman to be. Once you start looking at sound and frequency and resonance, all these ancient sites become very much easier to decode, it leads us a lot easier to a closer understanding of what they were.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about these tools, this cone-shaped tool. I think when we talked last time, I had mentioned to you that Dr. Danny Hillman, who's a geologist out there in Java, and he's excavating this amazing pyramid that's now dated into 28,000 years when it was...
Yeah.
He found similar tools than what you found in South Africa, but he actually scanned the tools and discovered that, like your tools, they were composed of crystallite materials in a manner that is completely artificial.
Yes.
And he believes, and actually I don't think he takes it as far as you do, but he believes that they were used in some manner that we just don't understand. And they're strange. They're very light. They're shaped to fit in the hand perfectly, and the composition is just amazing. They definitely were made with some kind of process. Have you seen any of his stuff? Have you had a chance to look at any of
that? I must admit I haven't seen them, but I wouldn't be surprised because it's completely supports everything that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these tools look like they were made out of a synthetically created crystalline substance would not surprise me. Mm-hmm. Because once again, if you can create the tools that can disturb the harmonic resonance of a stone or a crystal, then you can soften the crystal, or for want of a better word, melt the crystal without heating it up. Mm-hmm. So you can then reshape and reform it into another form or a shape, a crystal that will have a specific purpose for the need that you want to use the crystalline structure for,
right,
or the crystal for. So once you get that, once you understand that this is what these guys are capable of, and it really becomes very easy to understand or make more sense of the tools and artifacts that we find.
Yeah.
Fine. And I will have to have a look at what Danny Hillman is describing. Really looking forward to seeing that, because I've been so caught up with the Ubuntu movement. I've been doing very little research into these stone structures in the last year or so. And what I find is, remember that we're dealing with another important structure here. There's a stone or an artifact here. And those are the donut-shaped stones, the torus stones, that are scattered throughout Southern Africa.
Hmm.
And there are thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of these stones from an apparently Stone Age era, which is just unimaginable, you know?
Yeah.
Because on one hand, our historians tell us that Southern Africa was a sparsely populated part of the world. Hardly anybody lived here. And they were, you know, cavemen and pastoral people. They were hunter gatherers and so forth, and the Bushmen and the Khoisan and so forth, and they lived here for 50,000 years or whatever it was, and they used stone tools, hand axes, and primitive stone tools, and with those primitive stone tools, they made these highly sophisticated and precisely engineered donut-shaped torus stones.
Hmm.
Which is an insane statement, because you can't make those with other stone tools that are this precise. And the big problem is that if this was a sparsely populated part of the world, and we have hundreds of thousands of these very precisely made donut-shaped stones.
Okay.
We have a conflict. We have a huge conflict there.
Are these donut-shaped stones comprised of the same kind of material as the cones?
Yes.
Okay, so they're artificial, is what you're saying, or they were manufactured.
They're made by people, and they're made by these beings, and they are very, very powerful energy-generating devices. Now, mm-hmm. once again, this is a story of very slow discovery. It's taken me 8 years to get to this point. It didn't happen quickly. And by having fluke and accidental meetings with people that say one sentence or one word to you that suddenly opens up a Pandora's box, you know?
Ed
Leach Skullman being seen levitating the stones with ice cream cones in his hands, and that suddenly changes everything, you know? That opened up a huge field of knowledge and research.
Mm-hmm.
And then meeting leading experts in the world, scientists that are masters and experts in the field of hypersound and how sound is propelled beyond the speed of light and becomes a powerful, powerful tool and a generator of powerful energy. And having been able to talk to these scientists around the world like Rainer Gebensleben in Germany, mm-hmm. and Zvonimir, I forget Zvonimir's surname now, he's a Croatian, and these are leading experts in the field of hypersound, and being able to get information from them about what these donut-shaped stones actually do, how they work, mm-hmm. how they generate vortex field energy, and that's what they are. They're very powerful vortex field energy generators that emit, hold on to your hat, one of these donut-shaped stones that's probably about 6 or 7 to 8 inches in diameter, mm-hmm. Emits up to and around 3,500 decibels of sound, frequency of sound.
How is it? How does that do? You have to hit it, or does it get hooked up to something? Or?
No. It simply absorbs the ambient sound around it.
Hmm.
Even in its dormant state, sitting in a room on a shelf somewhere, it has been measured to emit that amount of decibels. It is insane how much energy it generates. So what that tells us is that if you input a high frequency sound into that hole, where it sucks it in like you see these torus shapes, just like the way that our solar system works, the way that our galaxy works, mm-hmm. the way that the atoms work, everything in our reality is structured in these torus vortex fields, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's exactly the same that happens here. So the stone sits there and it sucks in the sound and the ambience and the resonance from around it and amplifies it. It is in essence, not just the vortex field generator, but it's in essence a scalar generator. It's a scalar wave technology, right?
And you presented these to these different scientists, and this is their conclusion, or how did they?
Yes,
wow.
Yes, absolutely. And two of these stones are now in different laboratories in the United States. One is in Seattle, being researched by a team of really bright young scientists that are working on alternative energies, and another one is in Colorado, being worked on by people that were secret military scientists and secret government project scientists and some of the smartest scientists that money can buy, or money can't buy, should I say.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah.
And they're working on these torus stones, and it was in fact one of these torus stones that crashed the TSA system at the Doha International Airport. Because of the frequency that it, or electromagnetic pulse that it emitted, or whatever it did, shut down the TSA security system.
I think you told us about this. Is this when you were traveling with it and you had it in your suitcase?
Yeah. Yes.
You never said it shut down the system. That's funny.
It shut down the TSA security. That's right. They stopped the airplane. They hauled me off the plane. They made me open my bags. They couldn't believe what – they didn't understand what the hell did it, what could cause that kind of amount of energy. And this made me realize that, when they scan the bags as they go, they scan the luggage, all kinds of technology, very advanced technology that we probably don't know about, and all kinds of frequencies through the bag. And one of those frequencies must have hit that stone and gone right into the middle of the hole. Hmm. And that would have just gone ballistic. That just sent out a very powerful electromagnetic pulse, like, you know, probably many thousands of decibels. And that just shut down.
I guess you can't travel with those stones anymore, huh? Otherwise, you'll be questioned.
Well, I did. I traveled with another one to Germany, and that was okay. That didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
Interesting. You know. Yeah.
Would you say that the humanoids or whoever were around when those pieces were created were a different type of species to be able to actually activate those? Because I don't know. I haven't heard from you, or maybe you can tell us. Have you been able to activate any of these artificial stones that you've got in contact with?
Well, we didn't activate it. The TSA security scanning system.
Well, yeah, that was a freak accident. We don't like to hear about that because a guy knows how one of these things would do if it really got set off. But have you experimented with them to a point where you can actually get them to do something? These stones?
Well, that's what these labs, that's what I'm hoping these groups of scientists in Washington State and in Colorado are going to achieve. And I think they're still trying to figure out what to do, you know, and I'm giving them some ideas and suggestions, but I did actually see what they have done is they have, that's actually the most important thing. They have managed to trap the generation of scalar waves as a result coming out of the stone. They trapped the scalar waves in ice. So that's the one conclusion that they reached, that the stone does actually generate scalar waves. So that I can actually tell you is one of the first conclusive scientific bit of research that has come out of the Colorado laboratory.
Wow. So these could be weaponized too, couldn't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is why I can tell you, when George Bush said we're going to invade Iraq because they got weapons of mass destruction, the weapons of mass destruction were not what people think. Those weapons of mass destruction were in the basement of the Iraq Museum in Baghdad, the Baghdad Museum. And these are all ancient technologies, stone-based ancient technologies, that were immediately confiscated within the first 48 hours of the first bombs landing on those poor people in Baghdad.
Oh, my God.
Those giant pantechnicons pulled up in front of the museum, and they just completely gutted and loaded everything in the basement of the Baghdad Museum. That's where all the ancient technology was lying.
Wow. Okay. Now, I haven't heard this. That's a different spin on invading Iraq.
Yeah. Absolutely. Wow. Believe me, the things they knew about these things, and you know, we're getting closer and closer to understanding this stuff, and they may have anticipated that we're going to start to understand this, and some scientist in Baghdad is going to walk in there and go, oh my God, we got ancient advanced technology here. Mm-hmm. We can use it in our defense.
The others. Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny, with our high technology internet microchips and everything, it seems like we don't recognize ancient technology. We only recognize things that are made of metal, things that are computer based, things that are
yes,
you know, it's funny that you've discovered and other researchers have discovered this stone based technology. It's really an eye opener. Do you think we're missing a lot of the ancient past because we don't recognize it? We're looking at the ancient past from our perspective.
Absolutely. And the key thing here, Cliff, is money, because the ancients didn't have money. Okay, they didn't use money, so they didn't have to extract the silica and the quartz out of the rock, okay, to put it into fancy little thing called silicon chips, or into shiny metal boxes called computers so they can sell it to some dumb schmuck thinking this is advanced technology.
Right.
They understand the crystalline structure. They understand how to use it in its raw original form in the stone. And they can mold the stone and use the stone as the tool and the technology itself. You don't need to, you know, you can take a stone, a crystal, or a stone that is very rich in crystalline substance. You can smooth it off and you can turn it into a TV monitor. You don't need to extract the silica and put it into a shiny box The only reason we do that is because we have commerce and companies and corporate structure and the hierarchical structure mm-hmm. of control to enslave us, and technology is one of the tools of enslavement. So,
that's a good point, yeah.
You know, this is really very important. You don't need to extract it. And this is why, and remember, one of the major discoveries in the last few years is that we can store digital data in crystal, in raw natural crystal.
Right.
And we can store trillions of terabytes of digital data in one tiny little crystal. So you can imagine how much information can be stored in giant stones, giant megaliths, in how much in the stones of the pyramid, in Stonehenge, mm-hmm. in all the stone circles of Southern Africa. Infinite amount of information is stored in those stones. Mm-hmm. All these ancient structures carry all the knowledge and information of what happened to them in the past. It holds that knowledge and information in the actual structure, in the crystalline structure of those stones.
Yeah, that's going to be the big eye opener when someone figures out how to extract the information that's imbued in these stones. And I believe that.
Yeah.
I believe it's in a lot of the pyramids. In fact, I think the Maya have a lot of this in their technology and their pyramid building.
Absolutely.
I just don't know how far off we are. If it's 100 years away or it's 50 years away that we can begin using some kind of scanning technology to extract this data, because God, that will change everything.
Really, of course, will. And we're getting close to that. You know, we're understanding, and come back to the Ankh. You know, the Ankh in its original form was also an energy resonating device. The original Ankhs had little handle at that little head at the top, the little vibrating arms, and then down to the bottom were two legs. It wasn't just one leg. There were two legs like a tuning fork that piano tuners use. And that is the important thing to realize. And these gods or these beings, these supreme beings in Egypt, all had their own Ankhs. They were their tools. It was their, it was like a version of the cone-shaped tools. It's even possible that the Ankhs were used to activate the cone-shaped tools that they used, because they had Ankhs and they had the cones that they used in Egypt. So, and there's a very important thing here, that each one of those gods and kings in Egypt had their own Ankhs. They didn't share their Ankhs, like we don't share our toothbrushes. Mm-hmm. That Ankh was calibrated to your body's energy field, so you can use it, your body can use it. And the same thing with the cone-shaped tools. If we can channel our thoughts, what is a thought? A thought is a frequency, it's a vibration, it's a resonance. If you can think of something and channel that resonance of that thought through your body, from your brain, from your mind, through your heart, or from your heart into your hands, and through your hands into the cones in your hands, and that resonance goes into the cones and creates the Sazer beam at the tip of the cone. So you can use those cones with intention by thinking things like, I'm going to move that stone over there, and that the thought of that goes through the cones, creates the Sazer technology, the distortion, the gravity distortion fields. And you can start manipulating whatever it is that you intend to do with those cone-shaped tools. And this is the spectacular thing, and this is why I believe that our pineal gland was so severely manipulated, so that we could no longer have that capacity to do that. Only the gods and the priests and those who were the elite were left to be able to carry that kind of privileged use of the technology.
Are you saying that through genetic manipulation, we've lost the ability to use our pineal gland correctly? Or is it just because of the modern technology, the modern life?
And I think very distinctly with genetic manipulation and probably poisons, toxins, you know, fluoride, everything else in our systems. And I think that there are certainly some symbolisms in the ancient imagery and the carvings where you see these winged beings pointing cones, pine cones at the heads and the brains of people, and pine cones at the DNA, what looks like, most certainly looks like a DNA kind of structure, showing us that they used cone-shaped tools to possibly manipulate our pineal gland and also the DNA. So yeah, definitely genetic manipulation to prevent us from using using the cone shape, the pineal gland, which incidentally is connected to the optic nerve, and the optic nerve is what picks up the resonances and frequencies from your eyes. And what do we have in the retina of our eyes? Rods and cones, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once again,
fascinating. Okay, I want to talk about a subject that I enjoy and you talk a lot about, and that is the world of giants, the Nephilim. And in this introductory presentation that you give for Hidden Origins on Gaia TV, you speak about the Jewish Bible discussing different types of human giants, which are, they may not even have been human. They may have been E.T. Can you talk a little bit about that? You actually bring up a number of different species, which I find is interesting. When we think of giants, we think of one or two, biblical and maybe mythological, but you actually have found a number of species of giants that I guess were tens of thousands or 100,000s of years ago.
Yeah, well, I haven't found them. It's the Bible that talks about it. Yeah,
well, I mean, you found it in literature is what I meant to say. I'd love to see a skeleton, but, of course, that's tough, too.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible distinctly talks about, you know, the Gibberim, the Zamzumim, the Emim, the Rephaim, the Nephilim, and the Anakim, and these are all titanic races. They call them titanic races, and some of them are so large that we look like grasshoppers by their side.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about, you know, giants that are 12 foot or 13 feet tall. We're talking about giants that are probably like, you know, 20 meters, 30 meters tall. That's just insane.
Yeah.
And possibly bigger. You know, who knows? Who knows?
Were these guys all over the place, or do we know? I mean, you have a footprint there in South Africa that you show. It's pretty phenomenal. That person must have been 20 feet plus.
Probably more. Yeah. Seven, that would have been about 7.5 meters. That'll make it like 25 feet. Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge person to be walking around. But do you find them everywhere or just in your area? I mean, they're not in, maybe they are in Central America, but it seems like species.
I think they're probably everywhere. It's just, that is just one beautiful example of a footprint. And once again, you know, there's huge argument about how can you leave a footprint in granite, and again, that just shows the lack of knowledge and understanding of the geologists that come out of mainstream geology school, mm-hmm. who just regurgitate the same nonsense that we get taught about geology and how certain things are formed, and a complete lack of understanding or knowledge of the laws of nature, and how certain things can be manipulated. Mm-hmm. You know, there are very simple ways of leaving a footprint in granite if you just open your mind. if you take, for example, granite and you crush it, and this came to me from a Canadian gold prospector, third generation gold prospector in Canada. He said, "Oh, this is nothing new to us. This happens all the time." You know, we crush the granite, we process it, extract all the gold, and then we leave the wet sludge granite behind. It mixes with other rocks and stones, and then when we leave for winter, and we leave this wet cement-like thing lying behind, mm-hmm. and when we come back in spring, we often find animal footprints and bird footprints in it that have then solidified, and the granite has become hard, and it looks like rock. You'll never be able to tell that was once crushed and it was this wet cement like sludge.
It's amazing. Yeah, that's a huge footprint.
So what did I just tell you? I just told you that this came from a gold prospector. The whole history of Southern Africa is all to do with mining gold.
Yeah.
The Anunnaki seem to have been here for one. The main reason was to find gold, and they mined it, and they mined it on a huge scale here, specifically in Southern Africa.
Yeah.
And they seem to have had giants that they cloned. They didn't just clone humans. It seems that they also cloned these giant beings because they were very strong and powerful, and they could do things and move things that were a lot easier for them to do.
Hmm.
And it seems that it is one of those giants that left one of their footprints in one of these giant piles of what was left over from the extraction process of the gold, of this wet cement-like substance, mm-hmm. and they just stepped into it, and that then hardened, and now looks like granite, and no one can figure out how the hell that's possible.
Hmm. So your theory is that they were bred and that they were used for actually working, at least in that part of the world, that South African area.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a fact.
They were breeding humans for slaves in the mines, in the gold mines. And once again, you know, it's not just me saying it or thinking it. If you ask any South African trained Sangoma or medicine man, if you ask the well-known Kreta Mutwa, Zulu shaman, who's probably the best-known African shaman and in the world at the moment, mm-hmm. they will all tell you the same thing. The gods came to Earth and they created the African people to work as slaves in the gold mines.
Mm-hmm.
This is not new.
Hmm. Yeah, we don't hear from shaman. Shaman are not considered reliable information sources, and so science, at least modern science, does not recognize them. Same thing with Native elders in America, here in America and in Central America, that they don't listen to what they have to say about any of the history, and so we're left kind of blind with their discoveries and their interpretations, which just kind of drives me nuts. Actually, it's kind of it's kind of very, very myopic. Hey, listen, in the last few minutes we have here, I have a huge question for you. And that is, you're very big on the Anunnaki. And recently, very recently, Michael, Planet X has been discovered as a true planet that's supposed to come by Earth in the near future. Now, we know that as Nibiru and Planet X. And what do you think about that? What are your expectations? And there's scientific proof that there's a planet out there that's headed our way.
Yeah, well, you know, the Bible talks about the planet called Wormwood, which I find fascinating too.
Yeah.
In Revelations, and so it's just more and more evidence what the ancient texts have been and ancient cultures have been telling that, and this information is modern academic institutions and the media have been doing their best to suppress this knowledge and information, but it's getting to a point where it's become virtually impossible to suppress it anymore. So they've got to start playing along and sharing this information and leaking bits of it out. How much truth is woven into that and how much deception is woven into that remains to be seen. Because anything that comes through mainstream media is you've got to take with a pinch of salt, and because there seems to always be a hidden agenda attached to it. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going on there. I must tell you the truth. I don't. Okay. I can't figure it out.
But if Nibiru were to show up in Planet X, which I'll send you an article that just actually it's been out. A couple of scientists actually, one's an astronomer. Has seen it and has identified it by its energy pattern, I guess. Planet is headed our way. And if you could hypothesize, what would that say? If it's been hundreds of thousands of years since the Anunnaki were here, maybe it's a dead planet for all we know. But I mean,
Personally, I'm not sure if it's that planet. I have slightly different take on the Anunnaki and their planet, especially after getting into what Anton Parks has been writing about. And I really highly recommend for people to go find his work on the internet. A lot of it is now available in English, because until recently it was mostly in French, so it was difficult for the English world to get into. And his information is staggering and really detailed. Okay. It concurs a lot with Zachariah Sitchin, but it also differs a lot with Zachariah Sitchin because it's more refined and more detailed. And it certainly highlights a whole new side to the Anunnaki, or what many people have imagined them to be.
Okay.
And not just the Anunnaki, but a huge, vast array of other different beings and of shapes and sizes, and pretty much all of them are malicious, not nice, controlling, hierarchical, manipulating beings, and we seem to be caught up right in the middle of this part of the galaxy where they control vast number of, you know, galaxies and solar systems and clusters of galaxies, and have implemented this draconian kind of control and rule over many of these probably millions of planets, the way that they've imposed themselves on planet Earth.
Huh. Gonna have to look that one up. I can't imagine.
It's pretty much like Star Wars, but much worse than Star
That's
Wars.
That's not good to hear.
Yeah.
Wow.
But at the same time, I'd like to end on a high note, and I trust we're ending because I also have to go to a meeting. We're having a big Ubuntu meeting.
We're at the end
of our and they're talk. Waiting for me already. So I need to end on a high note. All of that is completely irrelevant because all of those people and these beings are fearful of us human beings. Not fearful, but they know that they can no longer interfere with our predestined fate to grow into higher levels of consciousness, to evolve into higher levels of consciousness, as our DNA activates and energizes and allows us to think higher thoughts, feeds back and activates more of our DNA, just like Lucy does in the movie Lucy. Mm-hmm. The more of her DNA she uses, the more she can think higher thoughts, the more she can manipulate matter and manipulate things around her, and the more she gets in touch with everything in creation and the Creator itself, realizing that she is one with the Creator, that we are all one with God. We are all one with the Creator, and this seems to be the human destiny because all of that stuff is encoded in our DNA. And that is the one thing that is the constant common denominator bit of information that I get, is that Enki, the architect of the human race and the DNA of the human race, did this on purpose, that he encoded all the knowledge of everything in creation into our two-stranded DNA, or the two ME tablets, or the two tablets of destinies that the Anunnaki had possession of for some time. And he encoded all that information into our DNA to hide it, but also to protect it from being destroyed. Because now it's in all of our DNA. Every living, breathing human being has this encoded. And this is our human destiny, to rise in consciousness, realize who we are, that we are one with the Creator of everything, and that we are Creator gods that resonate with that true source of creation. And that's the best part of this entire story.
Thank you very much. I'm glad that you did end on a high note because I was getting depressed there. Michael, thank you very much. It has been wonderful speaking with you, catching up. We will definitely want to promote you. You're continuing on with Gaia TV and the Hidden Origins series that people can go to, I guess, GaiaTV.com and download and see your series. I'll promote it, put it up on my website and on my Facebook page. Anything else you want to promote, any books, anything else coming out? Are you going to be in the States at all this summer, fall, winter?
Yeah, at this stage, I don't think I'll be in the USA. I'm not sure. However, okay. We are activating the USA very, very rapidly and very quickly with the Ubuntu movement.
Right.
It's just suddenly expanded and growing very rapidly. We have a core group of activators there now. So I'll probably come to the USA for our big first annual Ubuntu USA meeting.
Okay.
That is now being coordinated by a guy called Michael Sunseri, okay, who lives in Oregon, and it's really very exciting. So I'm looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to hearing more from you. And I'll be in touch, Michael.
Thanks very much, Cliff. Lovely talking to you, and look forward to our next chat.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
So I hope you liked that. I hope you enjoyed that interview. We will keep abreast of what he's up to. I think he said he's not going to be coming to California or the United States this year, but you never know. Gaia TV is produced in Colorado. And So he may be coming out to do some other work. You never know. So stay tuned for our next program. We have some fantastic guests coming up in March. Keep an eye on the Blog Talk Radio website. Also, always go to Facebook. Our great artist, Curtis, is always creating our banners for upcoming guests. March is looking to be fantastic, and we actually have a special guest, and I'll only say this, that in April 1st, our guest is the host of Ancient Aliens, and you're probably wondering, how can you, Cliff Dunning, have someone from Ancient Aliens on your show? Well, we've had a few other people, but April 1st, stay tuned, because that is going to be a very special show. All right, I hope you have a great day. Be well.